You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. I'm a totally rank amateur compared to Richard Frum, a world-renowned ornithologist, but I've experienced the thrill of seeing whooping cranes in Aransas, Texas, and I always feel a huge rush of excitement just here in Silver Lake when I see the great blue herons landing in the eucalyptus grove or hear the hooting owl outside our window at night. I agree with him that knowing the names and recognizing birds is a way to know the world. It's a deeply satisfying endeavor. But how do you explain the wonder of the peacock's tail? Darwin famously wrote, quote, "The sight of a feather in a peacock's tail, whenever I gaze at it, makes me sick." How is the extravagant design of the peacock's tail or the iridescent plumage of the hummingbird essential to a species' survival? In his new book, Prum tackles one of the questions that preoccupied Darwin in his theory of evolution, how do members of a species act as agents in their own evolution? Richard Prum is the William Robertson Co-Professor of Ornithology at Yale University, and he's the head curator of vertebrate zoology at the Yale Peabody Museum of Natural History. And this book culminates 30 years of his fieldwork and revives Darwin's long-neglected theory of sexual selection, in which the act of choosing a mate for purely aesthetic reasons, think of those sleepless nights when you hear the mockingbirds singing their entire repertoire, as an independent engine of evolutionary change. He's conducted field work throughout the world, and he received a MacArthur Fellowship in 2010. And tonight, Professor Prum will be in conversation with Amy Parrish, Dr. Amy Parrish, a biological anthropologist, primatologist, and Darwinian feminist, which will play right into our discussion tonight. Dr. Parrish has been studying the world's captive population of bonobos for the last 20 years, and her work has been featured in many publications. She has taught at various universities and was most recently here at Aloud to interview the philosopher of science, Peter Godfrey Smith, about the consciousness of cephalopods. And on that note, let us welcome our two guests, Richard Prum and Amy Parrish. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks for being here with us tonight. And Louise, thank you so much for those lovely introductions. It's a real pleasure to be here in conversation with Professor Prum from Yale University to talk about his lifelong love of birds and some insights that he has that are in some ways upending some of our recent understandings of how evolution works. For many of you, you're probably familiar with Darwin's ideas of natural selection and how species change through time in response to environmental situations and circumstances so that they can survive long enough to reproduce. But that's not the only idea that Darwin had. And Louise alluded to it in her introduction when she talked about how Darwin said that the sight of a peacock's tail makes him sick. So I thought that might be a good jumping off point for us. If you could tell the audience, why did Darwin find it so disturbing to look at a peacock's tail?
Well, when after Darwin published The Origin of Species, he had a few really big, outstanding intellectual problems. The first was genetics. He had no theory of inheritance, which his mechanism of evolution absolutely required. The other was that he had no elaborated theory of the origin of human beings, right? And that was a big challenge. And lastly, the other big challenge was beauty, ornament in nature. And it was seized upon by his critics as something that was obviously an example of the eye of the beholder. The beauty of nature for its, you know, created. And so he needed another theory of that. So there's some hints of it in The Origin, but he wheeled around in a very foxy way and came up with an entirely new mechanism for how ornament could evolve in nature.
Because these tail feathers seemed like they would be costly, right? Costly
right.
produced,
and obviously
maybe
the peacock's tail is so gorgeous But that gorgeousness and the huge amount of investment clearly wouldn't help it survive. And so it couldn't be explained by the mechanism of the survival of the fittest.
It might even hinder it, perhaps.
Absolutely.
In getting away from a predator. Yeah. Okay, so let's fast forward and then work our way back. So today in most textbooks, the way that Darwin's addendum to natural selection, which he called sexual selection, which was his explanation for how these traits might have evolved, is presented, focuses very heavily on a particular interpretation of how females choose mates. Could you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Maybe we'll start with an example of how the challenge. It's not the peacock's tail, but let's start with number four, a video here.
This is a real treat.
This is a video of a courtship display of the superb bird of paradise.
And where do they live?
And they live in New Guinea. And this is a male, and he's defending and displaying from a log in the jungle. And a female is going to visit him and evaluate his courtship display. Notice at this point that the eye is actually black. That's his shiny black eye. You haven't seen anything yet.
You think that's good.
The female's about to land upon the log.
So for those of you...
so it's an amazing and elaborate display, a combination of incredibly vivid blue colors and a super black orb. And if you listen carefully, you can hear him snapping his wings.
So it's almost like a cape that he's drawn up over his head.
Right.
It kind of reminds me of Carnival.
Or like an umbrella blown out by the wind.
And what do you call that beautiful blue horizontal piece across the breast?
Well, actually, in another whole part of my research life, we worked a lot on those. That's a kind of structural color. So it's an optical interaction of light with the nanostructures in the... It's like nanoscience of the birds. Okay. But it's a nanoscience of beauty in this case. So that's what the challenge was. And what Darwin proposed was that birds and organisms in general, when they had the social opportunity, would choose among various mates. And what we would get would be the elaboration of beautiful ornaments. And so he used aesthetic language explicitly in his description of that. So he talked about mate choice as an aesthetic faculty, or as preferences, as standards of beauty. And he imagined this process as being entirely independent of natural selection, as a distinct kind of evolutionary mechanism.
Right. And there was a lot to explain. If you think about the animal kingdom, there's quite a bit of display that seems kind of superfluous or over the top, and it might be plumage in the case of these beautiful blue breastplates, or it might be behavioral in the case of these courtship dances, or maybe
or the
vocal
songs of a wood thrush, or in fact, there's a whole realms of kinds of ornaments we don't imagine, like the pheromones of insects, or there are even fishes that sing electrical songs that vary in frequency and tempo, like our music. And we have no idea what it's like to sense these courtship displays that are electrical.
And would you say that most of the time it's the males who have the more elaborated?
Well, it really depends tremendously on the species. Okay. And the ecological context, right? So, in addition to the mechanism of sexual selection, there's a whole context of the ecology of reproduction. Mm-hmm. Why they might get to choose or have the opportunity to choose.
So in this bird of paradise, the male is heavily ornamented and the female looks, I mean, would you say to the untrained eye, she looks sort of plain?
Yeah, well, she is, first of all, they all eat fruit. So fruit, of course, wants to be eaten. So if you can feed your young on fruit, you can eliminate one parent at the nest. And that is hypothesized to lower the rate of predation. So once they get over the hump, then the females can select whichever mate they like. And of course, they're kind of drab because they're sitting on the eggs and don't want to be exposed to predation.
Okay. So I would say that in most textbooks today, you would read a characterization of sexual selection that would acknowledge that females are making these choices, but assert that there's a logic behind those choices that has to do with picking the best genes, for instance. Can you talk a little bit about that traditional understanding?
The way in which most of my colleagues in evolutionary biology think about mate choice today is that that display of the peacock or of that bird of paradise is communicating information about objective mate quality that choosers need to know, so that the female, in choosing that male or not, is getting some objective improvement about it. And this is basically saying that beauty in nature is a kind of utility. It's a means to improvement, and therefore that sexual selection and mate choice in general are a kind of adaptation. And the original Darwinian idea, however, is that mate choice is independent, or can be independent of natural selection, and that females or males are making their choices on the basis of what they want, what they like. And so in the Darwinian frame, the subjective experiences of animals, the internal experience, the flow of experience, what it is like to actually be presented with a display and how you think about it and what you want is a driving force in evolution. In the adaptive mode, we sort of explain that away. Mate choice is just another kind of means toward improvement.
So back in Darwin's day, he could appreciate these, or he learned to appreciate these elaborate displays and colors and stripes and patterns, although he didn't have an understanding of what that mechanism might be for what they were good for, I suppose, or what the explanation for that might be. It was sort of who knew why females like yellow or females like spots or stripes. It seemed like the aesthetic whims of the females. Are you returning to that idea?
No, well, actually, I think that characterization of Darwin is pretty modern. In fact, he argued explicitly with Alfred Russel Wallace about mate choice. Wallace, the co-discoverer of the mechanism of adaptation by natural selection, wanted that that idea to be the single powerful notion in evolution. And so he argued strenuously against mate choice and said, argued explicitly in favor of the kind of honest advertisement, the idea that the superb bird of paradise is like a biological match.com profile filled with information that females need to know. Who are his people? Does he come from a good egg? Does he have a good diet? You know, is he, what is he smoking? You know, does he smoke? These sorts of questions, right? And so, to the shock of most modern biologists, Wallace proposed the current hypothesis for honest advertisement or for quality indication in the 1870s and 80s. But when he did so, he said, this is natural selection. So he's credited with putting an end to the study of mate choice. But in fact, he articulated the modern version of mate choice that most people believe. So that characterization of Darwin, I think, is really about downgrading the aesthetic, the role of individual agency and desire in shaping the natural world.
That's a really interesting way of looking at it. Can you say a little bit more about how this would work, or do we have an example, maybe, of another example of the beautiful aesthetics that?
Well, sure. Well, one thing would do to explicitly contrast in number five, a single slide, to contrast natural selection on physical function, like the beaks of the Galapagos finches on the left side, with sexual selection on sensory or cognitive functions, when we look at the plumages of the catingas on a South American family of birds that I've spent a lot of time studying on the right. And we have a really great and elaborated theory of adaptation by natural selection to explain the beak of the finch. Those variations in beak shape that are heritable, that contribute to differences in function, will survive. And as a result of variation in seasons or islands, in seed availability or seed hardness, some populations evolve to big, robust beaks that are good at cracking seeds, large seeds, and others to finer beaks that are good at manipulating small seeds. So this is a kind of our well-understood mechanism. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing about natural selection is that we can describe it really well with physical function. You know, the beak has to work on a seed, which is a finite problem. And as a result, if you look at birds of the world, 15 or 20 different lineages have evolved finchy-like beaks, because cracking open a seed without teeth with a bird beak is kind of the same problem. So lots of convergent evolution.
Right.
In contrast, if we look at the plumages, we find that the function of the plumage in the blue and purple colors of the Katingas are to seduce, essentially, to attract and to succeed at attracting a female. The female is shown on the lower right, the brown individual. And these plumages actually function in her cognition, in her perception. And as a result, that task, the seduction of another individual, is a very open-ended one. And it turns out that her preferences, or the preferences and the traits that they're attracted to, co-evolve with one another, giving rise to, at least in the birds, 10,000 different ideas about what's beautiful. And we find much less convergence when the functional substrate is the mind than when it's cracking open a seed. And so that's the challenge that Darwin proposed, and I think his solution is still a good one.
It's really interesting to look at this contrast there between the female and these males. Are these all the same species that we're
looking
at? No,
these are three different species within a genus that has eight species, and you can see that the blue changes in hue and the purple changes in extent and a little bit in color. And so those are radiating from a single common ancestor. I would describe this as an aesthetic radiation to contrast directly with the Galapagos finches, which are famous as an adaptive radiation coming from a single ancestor radiating in a variety of beautiful ways.
So how controversial is this idea of that maybe these are, if we distill it down, kind of here we are in L.A., movie town, to a log line. So sort of one sentence description of what we're seeing here. Is it accurate to say that basically what you're arguing is females aren't picking these males on the basis of physical characteristics that indicate good genes, but more based on aesthetic preference?
Sure. One of the ways to imagine it is to compare I could get into all the population genetics mm-hmm. and the mathematical models, and we'd lose mm-hmm. a lot of audience. So I got to try to give an analogy that I think will allow people to take it home and think about it. One is to compare the origin of the value of beauty to the value of money. Originally, the dollar had value because we were on the gold standard. That meant that the dollar had value because it stood in lieu of a tiny piece of gold that we ultimately spent in Fort Knox. And you could take your dollar and even change it for gold if you wanted to. Don't ask why gold's valuable. That's another problem. But in that case, the value of the dollar is extrinsic. It's outside of the dollar. However, modern currency, since we left the gold standard, every national currency, and all the way to Bitcoin, the value of those currencies is a social contrivance, as Samuelson said. It's only by the fact that we as a group or a group agree to invest that thing with value that it has any value. In that case, the value of the dollar is intrinsic. It's in the dollar. So by contrast, my colleagues are basically on the evolutionary gold standard. They think that ornament in nature evolves because it stands in lieu of some other real or objective benefit, like good genes or worms for your babies or a mate without sexually transmitted diseases or a good territory. And the alternative, the Darwinian original, is the idea that, as I refer to it, that beauty happens, that beauty is arbitrary, that it doesn't incorporate any objective or extrinsic properties, that it's intrinsic, it's only a social contrivance. And in case of animals, or most animals, it's a genetically contrived process, right, where beauty simply is arbitrary. So the difference between the Wallacean and the Darwinian worldviews are whether or not beauty in nature is riddled with informative, detailed quality information, or whether it's merely stuff happening. But the stuff that happens is beautiful. So that's the model that I'm advocating for science today.
And when we look at this image here, it seems as though, could we surmise that in this species, females like blue and they like a kind of purpley red in general?
Well, what's really interesting is that the deeper blue, Katinga, is actually extensively in the ultraviolet. It's we're not seeing most of that brilliant color. That's the one with the extensively purple belly as well. So to me, the evolution of beauty is like a spinning top. There's a mechanism, a genetic mechanism that creates a norm, a normativity, where the population evolved to a single or limited standard of what's beautiful. But through internal forces and external influences, the top will skitter off in different directions. So as we look at the process of the evolution of beauty over the tree of life, we can see how beauty radiates. It changes over time. In some species evolving to be more turquoise, and others more UV, to have either a very small bib or a very big, broad belly, etc. So this is the way that we can kind of understand the origin of diversity in ornament.
And is it good to be able to select for diversity? I mean, is individual variation good in some way?
Well, evolution isn't about good and bad. It's about stuff happening. Right. And once you have the opportunity for, you have the sensory complexity enough to have perception, and you have the complexity enough to do cognitive evaluation, and you have the social opportunity for choice, then beauty happens. And it's not up to us to say whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. I happen to think that it's fascinating and certainly motivating for me to study.
So Rick and I were at University of Michigan at the same time. He was in grad school and I was an undergrad. And another scientist, Doug Jones, was there at the same time. And he went on to study averageness in human faces. I don't know if you ever encountered him during the years. So he was a grad student, too. I don't know what department, but probably not biology. Were you in biology or zoology?
Yeah. Ecology.
But anyway, so he was finding that there was a preference in humans for average faces and making the argument that that was the best bet. So very much in this kind of contemporary interpretation that every preference must have something adaptive underlying it. And so his idea was that maybe you prefer the most average because obviously it's been successful and so it's a safe bet. But it seems like if you're going for the beauty standard and beauty for its own intrinsic value, then you might not look for averageness. Is that right?
You know, what's interesting is in the aesthetic perspective, individuals look for what they want, what they like. And the rest is just stuff happening. What happens tends to be the evolution of a central tendency, but it's unstable because the ancestor of those Katingas were all blue, but you can see how they've radiated in the kind of blue. So sometimes you might be a little too turquoise or a little too ultraviolet and not successful. But under the conditions and times, that's the coolest thing that is, and the whole population evolves in that direction. And so the arbitrary view really, I think, captures something about the tree of life that we see.
That's really interesting. In bird females, are there species where it's an advantage for a male to have a big repertoire of songs, for instance, or to be able to do something new with a song?
Within bird song, there is a long tradition of applying the adaptive concept, and so in which case it's imagined that by having a large repertoire, a bird is showing that he's got a better brain. However, that doesn't explain the species where repertoire has evolved to be only one song. And then in there, it's often hypothesized that, well, this song is preferred because he's showing how repeatable he is, so he has a better brain. And so this exposes one of the problems with this idea, which is that people will work hard and hard to confirm that beauty is really a kind of utility. And when they fail to do it, they merely conclude that we haven't worked hard enough yet to show how it must be true. And so it's a little bit of a faith-based empirical research program. So one of the things I'm trying to do is destabilize that view and entertain the possibility that it's really about beauty happening.
In recent years, there's been a lot of emphasis in certain branches of science on symmetry, and particularly I think of some of the work in the field of ornithology that's really promoted this idea that individuals are kind of hardwired to look for mates with a lot of symmetry. Mm. And the poster child of that for humans is Denzel Washington. I'm not even sure how it was determined that he's one of the most symmetrical individuals out there. But somehow this has come to be widely accepted in the scientific community. And it's supposed to be something that across the animal kingdom is important. Now, I study bonobos, and anybody who's seen a bonobo will remember that females have large genital swellings that are markedly asymmetrical. They have all these lumps and bumps, so the two halves are different sizes, and males are incredibly attracted to them. And so I thought about that as I was reading your book and thinking that you might have some things to say about symmetry.
Yeah, well, the idea that symmetry is informative about genetic quality actually started in ornithology with work of Anders Moeller on barn swallows, where he looked at the fork tail and whether one feather on one side of the tail and the other were the same shape. And he hypothesized that mates really wanted, or choosers really wanted mates with symmetrical tails. That it was an indicator of good genes. Okay. And this was a bandwagon for about 5 to 10 years. And then the entire research program just collapsed. It turns out it was unsupportable. And people couldn't publish the papers that said, you know what, this doesn't work. This is not true. And eventually they dropped it. And now evolutionary biologists are kind of embarrassed because, in fact, I think there are a lot of hypotheses still like this that are respected. Right. Unfortunately, the fluctuating asymmetry paper or ideas are still extant in human psychology, in neuroscience, right, neuroaesthetics, and other areas. So that's still an ongoing. It's like a zombie idea. It's continuing without support.
And I feel like it's propagated by the evolutionary psychologists who give the rest of us a bad name. So evolutionary psychology is a branch of science that really is looking for universals. And so it will posit that all males want young, fertile females, and all females want older, resource-laden, rich men, things like that, and that these are universals. And then it causes other branches of academia to then criticize science as essentializing male and female nature. And it seems to me that your work is a welcome, should be welcome, right?
Evolutionary psychology is really the most extreme example of this adaptationist mission, trying to find an adaptationist explanation or the explanation of everything in adaptation. There's a lot of problems with that field.
So this is a great anecdote to that, to propose that perhaps individual preference is not all tied to a predictable search for good genes,
right? Or to adaptation. Actually, I've got some new research example from video number 3. If we could start. This is an example of a really extraordinary bird. No image yet.
It's coming.
Well, if you don't, you can just play the tape if we don't have the video. Oh, here it goes. This is the club-winged mannequin.
Where do they live?
From northwestern Ecuador and Colombia. And this is a lekking bird. It's in a family I've studied for many years. And this bird is singing with his wings. Just keep that another time through, and I'll let them hear it. If you look carefully,
that's not a vocalization.
That's
right?
Not a vocal sound. That's a song. That's a wing song. If you look carefully, you can see the wing feathers kind of vibrating over his back. Right? This is, by any accounts, a ridiculous way to communicate, right? But it is extraordinarily beautiful. Now, if we could go to video number 2, it took us about 20 years to figure out how this works. And this is work of Kim Boswick, my student now at Cornell University. And you can see the feathers vibrating at 100 cycles per second and bouncing off one another in the middle and rebounding out. And it turns out that's fine. And it turns out the way in which this works is that the feathers are rubbing together. It's a kind of what we call stridulation. It's working like a cricket. So one feather is rubbing against another feather, causing that feather to resonate with that sound. What's interesting, in subsequent work, Kim showed that in mannequins, that beauty is more than skin deep. in order to make those sounds, the male has evolved in enormous changes to his wing bones and his wing musculature in order to produce that extraordinary thing. And we've recently discovered that the female also has bizarrely shaped wing bones.
And does she sing?
She does not sing. She never sings. And so I'm describing this as a kind of evolutionary decadence. Through selecting on females that make the extraordinary songs, the female's daughters will also inherit these weird wing bones that are clearly a detriment to flight. However, that disadvantage will be traded off by the fact that she will have sons who sing beautiful songs. So over time, the entire population gets further and further and further from a good fit to the environment. Everybody, males and females, are flying worse and worse, right? And this is a really great example of the way in which sexual selection by mate choice can be independent of adaptation. And it's made possible by the fact that the wing bones develop in the egg at about day 6-7, or begin development, before the embryo has any determined or differentiated sex. So by selecting on the songs that they prefer, females are transforming their own daughters and creating new costs, but that's traded off by their interest in the beautiful songs. So it's an example of decadence in nature. And I think it's a kind of like a ridiculous fashion trend out of control. You know, clearly it's not functional, right? That can happen even in non-human species.
Speaking of decadence in nature, you have some really fascinating accounts in the book of selection that happens not on appearance and not on behavior or song or dance, but rather on the genital anatomy of species. And that also relates to sexual selection and how we become successful in passing genes to the next generation. And it's a pretty stunning video. Perhaps we should go to that next.
Well, why don't we start with some stuff, some advanced work, right?
Yeah, we don't want to set you up.
Yeah. So, in the Darwinian view, in the aesthetic view, individual animals have agency. They are agents in their own evolution. And in the adaptive view, people are busy explaining that away, right? And once we adopt the aesthetic framework, that opens up a whole possibility for understanding another phenomenon in nature, which is what happens when the individual choice is infringed by sexual violence or coercion, which happens in animals.
And much more widely than is typically acknowledged.
Right. So, with Patty Brennan, now at Mount Holyoke College, in my lab, we've been studying for the last 10 years the evolution of duck sex, which is an example of this kind of conflict.
And we have a member of the audience tonight who's a photographer, Judy Raffel, who took this picture of mallards, a male mallard chasing a female, and asked her audience online to title it. And everybody came up with these really happy titles and interpreted this as some kind of really nice interaction. And what could it be instead?
So what happens in a lot of puddle ducks, you know, the little quack, quack, quack of the green heads of those guys, is that they pair up. But then during the breeding season, when the eggs are being laid, other males will try to force copulation with those females. It's very violent. It causes direct impact harm on them. They can even die in the process. So it's really a big deal. What Patty discovered, and this is all made possible by the fact that ducks still have a penis. If we go to slide number 6, it's homologous with the mammalian penis. That is, it's inherited from a common ancestor, but it has many bizarre features, which is that it's counterclockwise coiled. It has lymphatic erection instead of vascular. It doesn't have a urethra that's an enclosed tube. It has a sulcus or an external groove.
So the urine comes down the outside of the spiral of the penis.
Right. And in this case, it's stored most of the time outside in the body. In the case of the duck, erection and intromission are the same event. That is, the penis erects into the female. Now, in biology, and in academia in general, we love to change lives. But the next video will change your life if you've never seen it before. And so if you don't want your life changed, use your mind, close your eyes for a little while. So let's go with number one. This is a high, slow speed, 100 frames per second video of a duck penis erecting. All right? And you know that it's science because we're using the metric side of the ruler. So that... Okay, that was actually enough.
Like
Nobody's going to forget what that. So that process takes place in about a third of a second, right? Mm-hmm. And in particular, the penis on that duck was about 20 centimeters long, which is, I don't know, 8 to 10 inches.
And what's the record for a duck penis?
The record is over 40 centimeters, 16 inches. But that's on a duck that's only 12 inches long.
So is that female? Is that just individual female preference? I like spiral-shaped penises?
No. That's where... Patty came to my lab and asked, you know, what's with that? and not surprisingly, she took the female perspective and discovered some really tremendous new detail. In particular, what was known previously is that the size of the penis is correlated with the frequency of forced copulation. That this is really about an aggressive...
So it's a male adaptation.
It evolves through male-male competition to assert or to force fertilization. But what Patty discovered is that co-evolving with the size of the penis is vaginal complexity of the female. That the females actually have a complicated shaped vagina that prevents intromission during forced copulation. And it's characterized by a series of dead-end cul-de-sacs at the bottom where the penis can get bottled up. And then above that is a clockwise spiral. So it's literally an anti-screw device. a chiral mismatch between the shape of the male and female genital tracts. And now, when the female solicits a copulation, the muscles of the vagina are relaxed and intromission is permitted. Freely. It turns out that in species where 40% or so of the copulations are forced, right, mm-hmm. a tremendous amount, only 2 to 5% of the offspring in the nest are extra pair. So that means that these females are 98% successful at preventing fertilization during forced copulation. Tea Party Senate candidate Todd Akin said...
Females have a way of shutting this down.
Females have a way of shutting that whole thing down. Is true of ducks. But in a way that informs us about something entirely unexpected, which is that freedom of choice matters to animals.
Yeah, it does.
It's not a concept invented by suffragettes and feminists. It's an evolved feature of social sexual species. So and the question, how could the vagina even evolve to do this?
Right. Well, and it highlights an area of sexual selection theory that Darwin really never talked about, which was conflict between the sexes. So he had this idea about female choice. He had an idea that males fight over access to females. But he never really talked about female-female competition. Anybody who's been to high school knows that females compete. And he never talked about males being choosy. Perhaps there are times when males don't take every copulation.
You know, The Descent of Man, where he published his book, where he published the sexualization theory, is just a huge book, and I don't think we read it carefully enough. And I can think of passages where he talks about each one of these features. He didn't have an elaborated theory of sexual conflict. In fact, I think that most of my colleagues don't have a really well elaborated theory of sexual conflict because it would exclude some of these issues with the ducks.
Right.
But with the duck, when the female gets the mate she wants, that she prefers, then her offspring will inherit the traits that she likes and that other females have evolved to share that preference, right? But if she's forcibly fertilized, then her offspring will inherit either random display traits that she hasn't evaluated or display traits that she's explicitly rejected. And so her offspring will be less likely to be sexually attractive to other females. So it's really aesthetic normativity, the evolved agreement among females in the species provides them with the leverage to advance their freedom of choice in the face of sexual violence. And I count this as essentially a feminist discovery in evolutionary biology, right? Not an accommodation to political or social theory, but a discovery that the kind of conflicts that occur within human cultures and contexts are fundamentally biological, and that a lot of the same mechanisms are at play, and that this is really made possible by the aesthetic, by not explaining away female preference, but acknowledging that there's something about getting what you want, and having that opportunity, and that there's a evolutionary consequence to not doing so.
You know, that makes me think about bowerbirds and what a female bowerbird wants, which seems so exotic and kind of also, it doesn't seem like it would have an adaptive value. Can you tell us a little bit about bowerbirds?
Sure, sure. Well, the bowerbirds are really informative. That's slide number 7. Because they've gone a different route with sexual conflict. Note that in the ducks, the penis gets larger and the vagina gets more complicated. It's kind of an arms race. Between male control and female reassurance of freedom of choice, yeah. Right? Once you go down that path, it's hard to change. But the bowerbirds show a different path, and bowerbirds, like some of the other aesthetically extreme birds, the female is doing all the nesting, and she's choosing her mate among available males. And the males do these elaborate displays at a bower, which they build. This is the bower of a great bowerbird.
And a bower is a kind of house?
It's not a nest. It's actually an aesthetic structure. It's a kind of seduction theater, right? The male builds it because the females like it. And it's shaped by her choices, but it's made by him.
So he builds it and he decorates it?
Yeah, and so this one is called an avenue bower because it's got a passageway in the middle and then two walls on the sides. And you can see in front, he's decorated it with white shells. In this species, it's mostly white things like pebbles or bleached sticks or shells. And this bird is from Broome in northwestern Australia. It's about a kilometer from a cliff face overlooking the ocean. And in the middle of that cliff face is a single stratum of fossils. So these shells in front of this bower are actually fossils. So this is an invertebrate paleontological curation project, right? And so when the male sings to attract the female from a perch about 100 feet above the bower, he's actually announcing, "Do you want to come over and see my fossil collection?" So that's actually a picture of the male, but he's sitting in the position where the female would come when she visits. So she sits inside the bower, and the male displays in the front with a bunch of really energetic and even kind of scary, overtly aggressive displays. He picks up his materials and makes these weird electronical noises. But in order to copulate, he has to go around the back. She's protected by the walls, which gives her a chance to pop out the front if she doesn't like what she sees, right? So the bower is obviously aesthetic. It's beautiful, right? It's a piece of art. And yet it has this other benefit, which is that it protects her from sexual coercion. So in this way, females and bowerbirds have evolved to use their mate choices to transform maleness in a way that gives them what they want, this rich aesthetic experience, but does not sacrifice or endanger their freedom of choice. So in contrast to ducks, the bowerbirds went down this other path, which I would call aesthetic remodeling, transforming maleness in a way that furthers female autonomy.
And in both cases, the bowerbird and the ducks, it's really a response to kind of an inherent conflict of interest between the sexes, right? That you wouldn't necessarily expect to be as strong in birds, maybe, as in other species, given that they often are both taking care of the offspring.
Well, but in this case, it's many of these species are made possible by the fact that they eat fruit. So, and in with high predation, and fruit wants to be eaten, unlike an insect. So insects don't want to be eaten. So if you think about feeding your babies on insects, it's a hard life, right? And in fact, it is. So you need two parents to raise those babies if you're feeding insects. But if you're feeding on fruit, fruit wants to be eaten. It's available. It's an advertising. And so you can get rid of one parent and hope to reduce predation. So that's sort of the ecological context.
And does that create then a divergence in male and female interests because the male is no longer investing in parental care?
Indeed, the female gains a freedom of choice. And what do they use those choices for? They use their choices for making, fulfilling their aesthetic desires.
And that might be one beautiful male, or it might be a harem of beautiful males.
Well,
a series of beautiful males.
In Lex, these aggregations of males are, of course, the female will mate with only one of the males, but it's a gathering of displaying males that occurs at the pleasure of the female. Mm-hmm. But if we could go to slide 8, that shows one point in bowerbirds. So bowerbirds have evolved to prefer these males that make these beautiful constructions. But as a consequence of their choices, the bowerbirds have radiated in this beautiful way. There's an explosion of different varieties of architecture, the different materials they gather, and that's all come about as a result of freedom of choice. So this is three or four different species of bowerbirds.
What are we looking at in the lower right?
The lower right is the hut bower, of the Vogelkop bowerbird from extreme western New Guinea, the island of New Guinea. And he's collected a pile of fruits, a pile of seeds, blue flowers, orange flowers, and is curating them all with great delicacy. These are among the most aesthetic of all creatures on the planet. These males spend enormous numbers of months of the year and many years perfecting and curating these display sites. So.
Well, we have about 5 minutes before we open up the floor for questions. I'm sure you all have a lot of questions. And do we have a lot of birders in the audience? A show of hands. Okay, a few and others with general interests in this topic. But your book isn't only about birds. You kind of delve into primates, including humans, so non-human and human primates. What's the take-home message there?
Well, the take-home message there is that the adaptive view of mate choice has really permeated the culture so that people, even teenagers today, grow up imagining that external beauty is actually about objective quality. And they conceptualize every variety of their own individual flaws or foibles or individualities as somehow diminishing from an ideal. And transforming that concept or that cultural belief, I think it's a really important mission. And so even though I've spent all my career working on birds, I decided to start talking about the aesthetic evolution of human sexuality. So the last third of the book is about sexual conflict and aesthetic mate choice in humans. It's been really really fun, and I hope informative for the field.
And, it's interesting because I remember when evolutionary biologists first started talking about how interpreting behavior in an evolutionary perspective applied equally to humans, along with all the other animals that we were assessing in those terms, it was controversial. And there were Marxist scientists at Harvard, like Richard Lewontin, a colleague of Richard Dawkins, who refused to accept that humans might be subject to these kinds of laws of evolutionary influence in our behavior. He really, as a Marxist, wanted to think this is free will and this is a choice. And it kind of seems like he'd be very, very happy with your work, which is really more about that free choice.
The interesting thing about human sexuality is that it's very complicated. And the reason it's complicated is because all mechanisms of sexual selection and sexual conflict are simultaneously occurring. You've got male-male competition, female-female competition, male mate choice, female mate choice. You have sexual conflict occurring with male coercion and female coercion. And on top of that, you have culture, right? So it's not surprising we get this do this badly. And someone who comes in with like one of those and says, this is the most important idea, is, of course, it's going to mess it up, right? But of course, we all understand and have the deep experience of the biological nature of our sexualities and the cultural impact of it, right? And yet, unfortunately, now, for the most part, the people that work on the culture of sexuality and the people who work on the evolution of sexuality don't have a really productive conversation, right? I think the aesthetic and the concept of sexual autonomy can really provide common ground where evolutionary biology can create a new relationship with culture studies, feminism, and gender studies. And so that's one of the goals of the book.
Oh, beautiful. Well, that is a wonderful place to take a pause and maybe explain the system for those of you who maybe it's your first time here. There are associates of the library with microphones. If you raise your hand, they will come to you. We ask that you please frame your question as a question and try to make it concise, and we'll try to get to as many of you as we can. But first, thank you, Richard, for being with us and sharing all of this.
Thank you. What a pleasure.
All right.
Hi. So if the aesthetic evolution can go down a maladaptive pathway, as in the mannequins, will that species eventually, do you predict that it will die out because of the maladaptiveness?
Yeah, I think that we actually have some population genetic theory that shows that that mechanism is plausible. And in it, if female preference or mate preference is strong enough, it is certainly possible for the species to go extinct. I don't think this is a shock. If species went extinct by this mechanism, we wouldn't have discovered them. They'd already be gone. But it's certainly a possibility. And many of the world's most beautiful birds, you know, certain kinds of species of birds of paradise with tail feathers that are 2 feet long are extremely rare. And that might not be an accident. Sure, over here.
My question is about the duck analogy or the example. So, and you talked about the anatomy of the male and female evolving in conjunction, where the male is trying to get in and the female is preserving choice via anatomy. Then you said 98% of the eggs are the result of the chosen mate. So my question is, why does it seem like evolution is working through anatomy and not, like, why is it not influencing behavior? It sounds like the assaultive behavior is not actually resulting in being successful. Yeah. So,
well, great question. A couple issues. One, there is still that 2-5%, and those of coerced copulations, right, of coerced fertilizations. So there's some window to success to males through the coercive behavior. The alternative, of course, at that point is nothing, right? Because they haven't been chosen. So they're either going to be eliminated or they're going to coerce. And so there's this little window. The other thing is that apparently there's no cost to these penises. So it's not as if there's a downside to the males that are in standard pairs to evolving this elaborate anatomy. So there's nothing to hold it back, and there's still this little window that will allow it to occur.
Next question.
I was in a eco park, and I just saw dogs mating. I thank you for now I understand how they look. I was there next to me. Scary scene. My question is there a species that you still haven't been able to figure out how they mate?
So the mechanics are well established. So by mating, you mean copulation. And most birds actually don't have a penis. And so as a result, copulation is just a what we call a cloacal kiss, just an apposition of orifices where sperm's transferred. So that's the way most birds mate. But in terms of the larger repertoire, sure, there are plenty of species whose songs and displays are not sufficiently known that we understand their aesthetic world, if you will. So there's lots of field ornithology still to be done.
And there's some great accounts in here of some of those discoveries that you made, you know, starting with studying one kind of mannequin and then learning about the displays of a different kind of mannequin and figuring
and
out that evolutionary history.
There are still
history.
Mannequins out there with unknown courtship displays.
Really interesting.
That we should go out and find.
Next question?
Yes, certainly.
You've used primarily really gorgeous birds in your presentation here, but on the mammal side, just up the coast from here, are elephant seals that most people, I don't think of as being particularly good-looking. And yet to other elephant seals, there must be some that are more attractive than others. How do species develop a sense of what's pretty?
Yeah. Well, first to elephant seals. In fact, Darwin's theory of sexual selection had two components. One was competition within a sex for control over opportunities to reproduce, or even control for over the other sex. And that's really the elephant seal model, that one big male dominates one part of the beach. The females come up to the beach to birth their pups and then to mate. And the fact that he controls that beach de facto means that he obtains all the mates, right? So that's a kind of the evolution of armament as opposed to ornament. But the question about how does it start is fascinating. For birds, there are over 10,000 species of birds, and they all have distinctive aesthetic repertoires. They all have different concepts of what's beautiful, right? But they didn't invent them on their own. It turns out that mate choice in birds probably evolved first in the Cretaceous or the Jurassic, maybe even amongst in a lineage of theropod dinosaurs. Right, so what's been going on is a transformation, a continuing, ongoing change in what is considered beautiful. So it's really this aesthetic radiation that explains the different ideas of what can be attractive, and then a lot of it is really stuff happening, but the stuff that happens is beautiful, right? So it's a lot of random effects and influences, environmental impacts, but also and changes in ecological opportunity.
I hope I can remember my question. I want to go back to the ducks. You talked about with the forced copulation, the offspring that come about as a result of that have the characteristics that the female is not interested in or dislikes. Do the mothers treat that offspring differently than she treats where the fertilization is welcome?
No, they don't have any concept of which copulation event led to which offspring. I mean, the eggs are laid over a series of one egg a day over a series of 10 days to 2 weeks, and then incubation begins. So it's totally removed from those experiences. In addition, they mama ducks abandon, unless they're swans, which have a sort of family group, they abandon their young very early on. So, no, they don't have any such variations in opinion.
Or
No. They never observed that.
I will just add, in primates, you know, there are species where males commit a lot of infanticide. They kill infants that they haven't sired. And so there's been a big question about why females don't... what kind of counter strategies females could have to that, for instance, not mating with these infanticidal males after they've killed their offspring. But one of the proposals to explain that is that at that point the infant's already gone. She has to make the best of the choices that are there in front of her. But another hypothesis is that maybe it's okay to go ahead and mate with this infanticidal male because at least she'll have sons that will go on to be successful in the same way. So it's called the sexy son hypothesis.
So, you've given fascinating depictions of very flamboyant male displays to attract females, which is kind of contrary to the stereotype of Homo sapiens and flamboyant females attracting the males. So, number one, can you give examples of flamboyant female displays at attracting males? And why would it be that most species tend to have more flamboyant male displays to attract females? Why would that have evolved? Why would it have evolved that way?
Great questions. So, yeah, there are species in which there's mutual mate choice, right? Puffins or penguins, where they're all ornamented, but males and females all have the same ornaments. So they've got preferences and ornaments, and so that's a case where everybody is equivalently ornamented, right? And there are situations where the female is larger, brighter, sings the songs, etc. A good one are what they're called jacanas. They're the birds with very long toes that walk around on lily pads in tropical areas of the world. And in that case, the female will get a large territory if it has enough resources in it. She'll attract multiple males. The males build the nests. She lays the eggs. They take care of the nest entirely, and she defends the territory. She's bigger than them, and she gives the displays. She's even got weapons. She has little spiky weapons on her wrists, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a case of the entirely opposite phenomenon. What limits the extremity is the eggs. Right, the most successful female jacana is still only laying, twice as many eggs as the least successful one. Right, but in these birds of paradise, the distribution of sexual success is like the contemporary distribution in the income distribution. Right, that is about 5% of the males are obtaining 50% or more of the copulations. The next 10-20% of the males are getting most of the others. And then the bottom 50% of the males are never copulating in their lifetimes. So that's an extraordinarily extreme variation in success, and that's what drives aesthetic extremity. So you can get much stronger sexual selection on the male side because of the differences in reproductive investment in each reproductive opportunity, the cost of eggs and sperm.
I had a question about the bowerbird. Oh,
where are you? Yeah.
I remember seeing the footage, I think the Attenborough footage, of the males stealing from each other's bowers. And so I guess my question was, does a baby male bowerbird learn from other males in the community or
really,
from its
really,
father?
Really fascinating or question. Really fascinating question. And we don't know a lot. It turns out that bowerbirds are members of a large group of birds that learn their songs. So there's already a component to learning of what's essentially the sexual phenotype, what it is that they are advertising, how they appear, and what ornaments they have. So there's a social ornaments already in this group. It's possible that aspects of bower architecture and ornamentation are learned. And the elaborate hut bower in Western New Guinea is a good example. Apparently, on different mountaintops that are as close together as 30 or 40 miles, the ornaments that they use are entirely different. And people have done great experiments where they put out either poker chips or different colored things in the wild, and then demonstrate exactly what preferences they have for colored materials. Right, and so it's hypothesized that spatial scale of variation in ornament is probably or could be cultural rather than genetic. But these birds are rare, and doing those kinds of studies is hard, so we don't actually know whether the bowers are learned. I have one right down front here. Okay. Sure. Yeah.
So going back to the ducks.
Always back to the ducks.
The ducks. No, it's not the ducks. The ducks has two populations, right? The ducks that are forceful and the male ducks that are forceful and the male ducks that are more like the Don Juan Suave approach, I guess. But my guess is that is the ducks are either one behavior or the other behavior, or they tend to display both behaviors depending on the occasion.
Actually, there aren't really good data on that. But it's true that once the female starts incubating in these ducks, the male leaves because he's got no further role in helping to raise the young. And so in the original paper, Patricia Brennan and I proposed that actually they had to be different males, as you proposed. But our new, this is why we do genetic modeling. Our new mathematical population genetic model shows, in fact, they don't have to be different males. These strategies can evolve, even if there are individuals that are both attractive and coercive. They don't have to be distinctive. And that it's I think it's more common than we anticipate.
Hi, I'm going to try to put this into a good question, but all I can say is that I don't have a horse in this race, not having known very much about either theory, and yet I when you say with a certain sense of glee,
I noticed that beauty
happens. There was a part of me that found that upsetting, and I can't quite put my finger on it, sort of philosophically. But I think it's partly because, well, if beauty happens, then other stuff happens that we don't like and that we wish weren't continued in, you know, evolutionarily. And I'm just wondering if you could sort of take my sort of silly question and put it in terms of the kind of philosophical arguments that might be in your field, why people would be pushing back against the idea that beauty happens.
You know, that's great. Actually, in the introduction, I tell a story about describing my opinion to a professional colleague over lunch. I was visiting at a university, giving a seminar, and I went out with one of the colleagues there, a professor at the university, and we had lunch, and it took me 30 minutes to, because of course you say something and then a biologist will say, well, what about blah, 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 and they'll interrupt you, and then you go on to the next. And finally, after 30 minutes, he finally understand what I now would describe to you as beauty happens. And he said, but that's nihilism, right? So here I was, you know, going to the office, studying the beauty of birds. I'm getting goosebumps. I'm so excited, right, by this engagement with consequence of the subjective experiences of animals over evolutionary time. And my theory, when he finally understands what I'm saying, he feels that he wouldn't have a reason to get out of bed in the morning, right? And I'm like, what's the problem here? And it was that moment I realized two things. One, I had to embrace Darwin's aesthetic language. Because at that point, I was just talking mathematically and population genetically about, you know, the coevolution of traits and preferences. And I also had to write this book because I'm trying to communicate a view of the natural world in which people can see that to get goosebumps thinking about how beautiful birds are is a scientific plus, right? That is leading us to a better understanding of the natural world. And, the fact is that evolutionary biology grew and often recruited people who came into the field because they had a transformational experience when they read The Selfish Gene by Richard Dawkins, right? Mm-hmm. And that is like an icon of this whole field of seeing adaptation as a strong force that dictates the way the natural world is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I missed out on that. Somehow I got into evolutionary biology by a different path. Well, bird watching. And, so part of the goal of the book is to recruit into the science people who want to live this experience and hopefully help me to transform the science itself.
Thank you so much, everyone, for being here tonight. Thank you, Rich.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.